Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105 Radio.
Here is a special announcement. Today is Tuesday, and not, as is announced in today's Sunday Telegraph, Friday. And now, a repeat of last Thursday's performance of Monday Night is Music Night.
Welcome back to Evening Under Lamplight with Robert Louis Abrahamson at Cambridge 105 Radio. You can always reach me by email at lamplight@cambridge105.co.uk and can view all the archived shows by clicking the Evening Under Lamplight link at momentsunderlamplight.co.uk. Your comments are always welcome. And you are welcome to and invited to attend. And here's a little scheduling announcement. Evening Under Lamplight used to come to you fortnightly. That means every other week, sometimes twice a month, sometimes three times a month. But we've changed things, and it will be broadcast on the second and fourth Wednesdays each month. So only ever twice a month. But we're also going to prepare only one show a month, going out on the second Wednesday in the month. The fourth Wednesday of the month will be a repeat of the show from the second Wednesday of the month. So we'll have the same show repeated once a month, going out twice a month. On our second broadcast, of course, we'll be picking up those who may have missed the first broadcasting, or we'll offer a second listening to those interested in hearing again what they first heard, picking up things they hadn't caught, giving the songs another listening to, and the ideas some further thought. Okay, got that? And next month's show in December will be special. Our bicentennial, episode number 200. We'll bring back some highlights of previous shows as well as some new celebratory material. Be there, as we used to say in Philadelphia, or be square. This evening, I thought we'd attend to the themes of sun and moon. Sunshine, moonshine, light and dark. Maybe this is the best time of year for this theme as we become more and more aware of the shortening of the days and the impinging darkness, not just literal darkness, but moral, political, ecological, even economic darkness. But mainly I thought it would be good to attend to this theme because I wanted to share with you a little story by Jane Yolen, The Moon Child, which our discussion will lead into. So some discussion and some music and then the story. But of course, you'll immediately have realized that we've chosen a theme far too large to handle in just a small radio show. But that's okay. We never aim for comprehensiveness, only suggestiveness as we play around with images and themes and music. And there's so much music we could have chosen, but I've chosen only a few groups who come on stage here several times. We'll start with sunshine first, using our imagination to remember those hours of sunlight as we sit here in the evening under lamplight. Well, here's a song I always used to play when I would wake up in the morning and the sun was shining brightly. It's a simple Paul McCartney song, even a mindless song, but its insistent good spirits conveys one of the great feelings of clear sunny days. It's an odd Beatles song, in that there appear to be no guitars, just Paul on piano and then bass and Ringo on drums, with George Martin adding more piano later, and John and George coming in only for the vocal harmonies.
Good day, sunshine. Good day, sunshine. Good day, sunshine. I need to laugh, and when the sun is out, something I can laugh about. I feel good in a special way. I'm in love and it's it's a sunny day.
Good day, sunshine. Good day, sunshine. Good day, sunshine.
We take a walk, the sun is shining down. Burns my feet as they touch the ground.
Good day, sunshine. Good day, sunshine. Good day, sunshine.
Then we lie beneath the shady tree. Loving me, she feels good. She knows she's looking fine. I'm so proud to know that she is mine.
Good day, sunshine. Good day, sunshine. Good day, sunshine. Good day, sunshine. Good day, sunshine.
So that was Paul McCartney's salute to the sunshine. In contrast, here's George Harrison's greeting to the sun. Here comes the sun. There's a calmness about the song, a feeling not of joyful welcoming, but of an exhausted relief. At last, the sun has returned, as one would have felt back then in April 1966, an extremely sunny month, so I understand, after a long, cold, lonely winter. Even the clapping two-thirds into the song seems just an attempt to call up some energy. Unlike Good Day Sunshine, which just exults in the moment, enjoying a walk and lying on the grass, sharing it all with the lover, unlike this, there's a larger context to George's song. Here comes the sun indeed, but as a contrast to what feels like years since it's been here. And it's not that the children are smiling because of the sunshine, but their smiles returning to their faces, keeping us alert to the contrasts of those long months when there were no smiles, apparently, and even further back to the months before that when they had been smiling. But it's that heavy winter time that pervades the song. Little darling, I feel that ice is slowly melting. Little darling, it feels like years since it's been clear. And the response to all this? Not a hurrah, but simply, I say it's all right. That's about all that winter heaviness has left him the energy to say.
All right.
The Beatles, Here Comes the Sun. Well, we say the Beatles, but John Lennon's not here. He was recuperating, I see, from a car accident. What would his presence have added to the song? Made it darker, wilder, funnier? Well, so we've seen, I think, two aspects of the Sunshine Moment. First, there's the vibrant, clear, upbeat mood under the god Apollo, associating this hot, life-giving light with clear reasoning and with skill and talent and excellence. All these attributes of Apollo, all these things that are shining. Phoebus Apollo, which means shining Apollo, strong, masculine energy. But if the sun itself shines with masculine energy, we can shine with feminine energy as the sun works or plays on us, inducing in us a more sedate, receptive, even passive mood of just opening up to the sunshine. Metaphorically, such a relaxed mood can represent a kind of satisfaction of all desires, a place in the sun where there's hope for everyone, where my poor restless heart's got a run. We strive for this and that. We are prodded and spurred by all sorts of things. Or like little Joe in Dickens' Bleak House, we're told over and over to move on. But through all this, we retain that hope for a place in the sun, as it is for Stevie Wonder on this original vinyl track from 1967.
Like a long, lonely stream, I keep running towards a dream, moving on, moving on. Like a branch on a tree, I keep reaching to be free. Feeling sad, I want you to always remember, yes, there's a place in the sun where there's hope for everyone, where my poor restless heart's gotta run. I know there's a place in the sun.
Stevie Wonder, yes. There's a place in the sun. All right, here's someone else just sitting in the midday sun. It's the tramp, the misfit in the Kinks Preservation Part 1 album, who stands apart from the Meshuggahs of the world with its fractional fighting and its frantic striving for power, possessions, and prestige. His only comfort comes from just absorbing the sun. I've got no need to worry. I'm in no hurry. I'm looking at the world go by, just sitting in the midday sun, just soaking up that currant bun, with no particular purpose or reason, sitting in the midday sun. He belongs to that traditional literary character, the outsider, spurning the things of this world, content with the little things that are free. Everybody say I'm lazy. They all tell me get a job, you slob. But I'd rather be a hobo walking round with nothing than a rich man scared of losing all he's got. Or again, I've got no home, I've got no money, but who needs a job when it's sunny? That innocent, even naive voice, the puer, the little boy, wondering what all the fuss is all about. It's the fable of the ant and the grasshopper without the winter judgmentalism. Everybody thinks I'm crazy and everybody says I'm dumb, but when I see the people shouting at each other, I'd rather be an out-of-work bum. And there's the kink in the song, the twist, the word bum, deflating any loftiness here. A blunt, ugly word, in fact. But who cares while we're just sitting in the midday sun? Is this voice just barely on this side of sanity? Well, again, who cares?
I'm sitting by the side of a river, underneath a pale blue sky. I've got no need to worry, I'm in no hurry. I'm looking at the world go by, just sitting in the midday sun, just soaking up that current bun, with no particular purpose or reason. I'm sitting in the midday sun. Everybody say I'm lazy. They all tell me get a job, you slob. But I'd rather be a hobo walking round with nothing than a rich man scared of losing all his got. So I'm just sitting in the midday sun, just soaking up that current bun. Why should I have to give my reason? Can't afford a telephone, and I haven't got a stereo, radio or video, a mortgage, overdraft or bank loan. The only way that I can get my fun is by sitting in the midday sun, with no particular purpose or reason. Everybody says I'm dumb, but when I see the people shouting at each other, I'd rather be an out-of-work bum. So I'm just sitting in the midday sun, just soaking up that current bun, with no particular purpose or reason. I'm sitting in the midday sun. Thank you.
The king's sitting in the midday sun. I wondered a minute ago if this voice was just ready to crack up. And the voice doesn't sound all that stable after all. It seems to be straining a little too much. And those moments of jingling music, a bit of La La Land. But there's no doubt in this next song, Look a Little on the Sunny Side, from 1972, a year before Sitting in the Midday Sun. Ray Davies' voice sounds much more desperate, much more on the brink, backed by a woozy, drunken brass section. The rhythm seems trying to get into a waltz lilt, but it never quite makes it, as though the brass gradually loses energy. The song is set in the world of popular music, the artist, a kind of tramp, after all, trying to be true to his art in a world of commercial superficiality. You try to give them what they want, but it never works. It's very hard, he laments. It's very hard to please the people every single time. But look a little on the sunny side. Sure, why not? Look a little on the sunny side.
Look a little on the sunny side. Even when they say you're on the slide, and for a while they'll say your records never make it, but in a while they're gonna be showering you with praises. They'll give you mediocre reviews and put you in the underground for a while. But look a little on the funny sunny side of life. Look a little on the sunny side. You sing them the blues and then they ask for a happy tune. And when you start to smile, they say, give me that rhythm and blues. And when you give them the rhythm and blues, they'll simply smile and say, we didn't want to hear you play, we didn't like you anyway. It's very hard to please the people every single time. But look a little on the sunny side. Ever upset you, cause for a while the cynics will all be out to get you. You gotta be shrewd, you gotta be strong, you gotta convince yourself that you're not wrong. Whistle a tune and think of a catchy happy little song. And look a little on the sunny side.
And of course, there's that most famous Kinks song about sitting in the sun, Sunny Afternoon, depicting a world where all has collapsed, at least his world has. The taxman's taken all my dough and left me in my stately home, lazing on a sunny afternoon, and all I've got's this sunny afternoon. You know the song, and in fact we attended to it not that long ago on Evening Under Lamplight, so we'll just glance at it and move on. We'll probably be having our third Kinks song later on to make it another Kinks hat trick. And now it's time to pivot over from the sun to the moon. And as we do this, we take a moment to remind you that you're listening to Evening Under Lamplight with Robert Louis Abrahamson on Cambridge 105 Radio. And now, back on the stage for their hat trick are the Beatles with a cover song and with John Lennon rasping out his rock and roll energy with Mr. Moonlight, sometimes considered the Beatles' worst track. But I can remember when I first heard it, and its unapologetic energy and absurd lyrics made it noticeable and then catchy. And here's what Dave Rybachevsky says about the song. "The sense of humor is very much on display in this song," he says. "How much of Mr. Moonlight was done tongue-in-cheek is hard to tell, but an examination of the ingredients that make up the performance is very telling. For instance, the straight, impassioned vocal delivery from Lennon, the African drum bursts from Harrison, the monotone background harmonies, and the cheesy organ solo all demonstrate the gaudiness of the track. As Tim Riley states in his book Tell Me Why, by taking the whole thing so seriously, they actually make it hysterical. But here, see what you think.
You came to me one summer night, and from your beam you made my dream, and from the world you sent my girl, and from above you sent us love. Love you, Mr. Moonlight. Mr. Moonlight, come again, please. Here I am on my knees, begging if you please.
And the night you don't come my way, I pray and pray more each day. 'Cause we love you,
Mr. Moonlight.
And the nights you don't come my way, oh, I pray and pray more each day. 'Cause we love you,
Mr. Moonlight. Mr. Moonlight, come again, please. Here I am on my knees, begging if you please.
And the night you don't come my way, we love you,
Mr. Moonlight. Mr. Moonlight. Mr. Moonlight. Mr. Moonlight.
The Beatles' Mr. Moonlight. Not a song you hear very often, perhaps understandably. And of course, there's also a moon dance. Can I just have one more moon dance with you? A kind of moonlit version of Good Day Sunshine, enjoying the moment in itself. I want to make love to you tonight. I can't wait till the morning has come. Moonlight, that soft, dreamy time, just right for romance. But we'll pass by Van Morrison for the moment. And then there's the shadowy world of Moonlight, the moon shadows. Cat Stevens' song takes us back to last time's theme of loss. And if I ever lose my hands, lose my plow, lose my lands, I won't have to work no more. Is it that fear of loss that comes to him when he's being followed by a moon shadow? A fear that somehow dispels all fear? We should go back to A Midsummer Night's Dream to see the way the moonlit nighttime contrasts with the rational, sunshiny world. Athens, with its rational legal system, too much of which becomes rigid and oppressive, driving the young people out into the moonlit world of the forest, a magical world where fairies and other spirits are anything but rigid and oppressive, though their carelessness, brings pain to us poor mortals, pain to the immortals too, as Oberyn jabs at his queenly consort, ill met by moonlight proud Titania. And as Bottom and several others discover in the play, the moon or luna can lead to lunacy, a nighttime madness that distorts all reality. A world of dreams, sometimes nightmares, sometimes revelations, sometimes both. Joseph Campbell, as we have noticed before, characterizes this descent of the mythic hero into the moon-controlled underworld experience as presenting a dream landscape of curiously fluid, ambiguous forms where the hero must survive a succession of trials. We've had a Beatles hat trick this evening under lamplight, and here come the Kinks back for their own hat trick. The song's called Full Moon, a later, campier, darker, spookier song than the two we heard a little earlier. I don't know if this song is scary or pathetic or what. There are some fine, mad images haunting this poor man who, with no choice of his own, is turned mad by the full moon. That full moon can stand, of course, for any strong influence that takes us beyond ourselves, beyond the selves we're used to inhabit, into a midnight disguise. Just another persona we project, this time without choosing to. Let's spend a minute with these lyrics before entering the song. Haven't you noticed a kind of madness in my eyes? It's only me, dear, in my midnight disguise. Pay no attention if I crawl across the room. It's just another full moon. Don't be afraid of me when I'm walking in my sleep. Don't get alarmed, dear, when I start to crawl and creep. Try not to listen when I mumble like a loon, that is, like a lunatic. It's just another full moon. This sounds like another version of the poor innocent boy we heard in the other songs, confused by all that's happening to him. But maybe he begins to get a sense of what's working on him in the next stanza. But that just takes him deeper into despair. You see before you a truly broken man, 'cause when it gets to midnight, I don't know who I am. Full moon's a callin', and it's put a curse on me, and it will never set me free. The full moon's still up there, like a great white balloon. The owls are a-callin', and they're singin' my tune. The night keeps a-callin'. I wish the day would come soon to get away from another full moon. And then he turns to us with some sort of comforting advice. If your hands start shakin' when the night starts to fall, if you're scared of the moonlight and the shadows on the wall, if the face in the mirror isn't you at all, it's just another full moon. Yes, just another nighttime horror, just like everyone else's. Well, let's take it away.
Thank you.
So there's the poor Schlemiel, transformed by the full moonlight. He knows it's not his true self, but an unknown persona taking over him, at least until, inevitably, the day arrives to dispel this lunatic possession. And so there we are, back to the sunlight, the daylight, healing what has been hurt in the darkness. Apollo, the god of healing, as well as all those other things. But you know what? You know what? Apollo was not the god of love. In fact, in all the mythic stories, Apollo's love for others is always frustrated in one way or another. So we need that moonlight, the mystery of love, the magic of love even. Well, we need them both, sun and moon. And let's not fall into the trap of thinking we have to choose one or the other. We need to dance with both sun and moon, and that's the point, I suppose, of our story, which is coming up next. Jane Yolen's Moon Child is one of those stories that seem to be written for children, but because it is told with the simplicity of a fairy tale or a myth, it has the power to be extended and applied to many aspects of our grown-up lives. It can illustrate the way we need to enter the dark woods, the path of Dante Alighieri, the path down to the hellish depths so we can come out healed, the path through the dream landscape of curiously fluid, ambiguous forms, which are frightening to our ego self, our social self. And there's also a sense of our longing, like the children in the story, for the depths of the dark mystery, but never quite finding what we're searching for. Or the Moon Child can be seen as a fable for our time. The people all fear anyone who is different, especially someone who answers the call to delve deeper than the clear, sunlit world of certainty. This is the way we've always done things, and that's the way it's going to stay. People who never go into the darkness, or if they do, as at the end of the story, they quickly run out again. They're afraid of what that darkness might show them or do to them, and as Jane Yolen says, fear begets anger, and anger seeks a victim. Sound familiar? Well, let's go over here where we can sit comfortably for story time. The Moon Child. There was once a land called Solin, where all men worshipped the sun. children were born in the day and brought up in the sun's light. Lads and lasses courted at noon when the sun's power was at its height. And the dead were buried at the sun's waning and were afterward known only as shades. All the people in Solin closed their doors when darkness fell. They gathered around their own home fires for food and for prayer. There they sang hymns to the little sun, as they called the flames that flickered in every hearth. Now in that kingdom was a great forest, which all men feared, for it was dense and dark and so tangled with undergrowth and so arched over with trees that no one dared enter it. The Solinians called it Swartwood, and they named it only in whispers. Year by year the trees of Swartwood tried to advance on the kingdom, and year by year the men of Solin cut the outermost trees back. It was these cut trees that burned in every hearth as a tribute to the sun. Now it happened once in that kingdom that a baby was born not at noon as was the custom, but at night in the light of the moon. Pale and wan, she grew tired in the sun and seemed to flourish only in the evening. And because of this, she was known as Mona, which meant moonchild. Mona was a lonely girl, for her paleness frightened the other Solinians. They were all tanned and strong from the sun, while she seemed weakened by each day's light. They warned their children to leave her alone, and so the children did. For strangeness begets fear. Even Mona's own parents seemed to shun her, seeking out their own friends to walk with and work with in the sun. So Mona learned to play by herself, seeking out the few shady places in Solin. And on the day she turned 13, forsaken by the children of her own age, she discovered the darkling woods. Swartwood was a name used to frighten bad children. It was a place to make the strongest men in Solin tremble. But to Mona, Swartwood was cool and inviting. At first, she had merely strolled by its edge, testing her fear of the stories told about the wood against her desire to know what lay hidden in its shade. And then, on her birthday, the 13th one she had celebrated all by herself, she resolved to enter the dark woods. If some evil befell her there, she thought it would just serve to show her parents and neighbors what her loss would mean to them. She drew in a hasty breath, closed her eyes, and walked down an arched-over path into the very heart of the wood. Nothing happened but the whisper of wind in her ears and the cool shadows on her face. Mona opened her eyes and looked around wonderingly. There were soft mosses underfoot and climbing flowers that bloomed when the sun started down. There were ferns with fleshy leaves and fruit like faded grapes. And on the bank of a transparent pool, Mona discovered a large plant with brilliant purple flowers and pods that were as clear as the water nearby. At evening, refreshed and cooled, Mona returned to her home. No one, in fact, had missed her, and where she had been, she did not tell. Soon Mona was slipping away from her house early every morning and running into the woods when she thought no one watched. She gave each plant a name. "This one," she said, pointing to a fragrant white blossom, "shall be Moonflower. And this one, Moonseed," she said, pointing to a climbing vine with heart-shaped leaves. "And that fern I shall call Moonwort, for the idea of the moon would not leave her." Mona built a bower of trailing vines and lined a path to the door with milky white rocks she called moonstones. And for the first time in her life, Mona was content. It was not long before the other children noticed that Mona was wandering down to the overshadowed paths, and after a while the bravest of them followed her. By ones and by twos and by threes they crept to the edge of the forest to watch for her, though they did not dare go into the woods. Some called her names and some mocked her, but they waited a long time to see if she would return. Return she did, in the late afternoon, just before dusk, with a strange, contented smile. The first day, the children who had waited laughed at her and teased her with questions about the dark wood. Mona merely smiled. She pressed on them some of the cool, white, milky stones she had gathered from the woods, but they did not dare to take the stones and ran from her in fright. The next day, when Mona returned from the forest, the children taunted her and called her names. Again she said nothing, but smiled and offered them fragile blossoms such as they had never seen before. And though many of the children ran away, a few of the girls thought the blossoms pretty and put them in their hair, where they seemed to grow and open with the coming night. The third day, all the children waited at the forest line. This time, when Mona appeared, they questioned her again, and now, although they were still frightened, they were also eager. And this time Mona answered them, the smile still playing on her mouth. "There is a place," she said, "deep in the wood, where it is neither night nor day, where sunlight and shadows meet and dance together in ever-changing ways." The children repeated this to themselves over and over and over again until it became a chant, and they accepted her presence and brought them home. But such angry scenes greeted them there. Fathers and mothers gathered the stones and blossoms and in a crowd marched to the edge of the darkling woods. There they threw the moon gifts as far as they could into the deepening shade. "Lie there, devil rocks," they cried, as the milky white stones went flying. "Grow there, devil seeds," they called, as the fragile blossoms were caught by the wind. The children did not understand their anger and were saddened by the loss of their gifts. But the mothers and fathers of Solon could not throw away Mona's tale of the secret place in the wood or the impression her strange smile had made. So the men of Solon gathered in angry councils, for fear begets anger. They argued before the safe, bright hearth fires, first in one home and then in the other. "She will bring the evil spell of Swartwood to our homes," they declared. Their wood piles grew taller than before as they cut back even more trees from the forest. But still it did not seem enough to make them feel safe. "Her heart is as dark as the woods," they decided. And it was then that the people of Solon knew that Mona must be driven from their land, for anger seeks a victim. So the men met and armed themselves. Their women formed behind them in a thin row, and behind them were the children in scattered bunches, some weeping and some crying out, and all very much afraid. Only Mona's mother and father remained at home. They were mourning that such a thing had come to pass, though at the same time they were secretly relieved to be rid of her. And late that afternoon, when the sun's shadows were beginning to lengthen on the land and Mona came out of the woods, she was met not by ones and by twos and by threes of curious children, but by an angry mob of Solinians. They shouted and shook their fists and ran toward her, their raised axes gleaming dully in the sun. The pale girl looked at them for a long moment and then quickly turned and ran back to the tree-arched shadowy wood. The people of Solon were by that time so angry that they chased right after her, waving their axes and fists at her back. They threw rocks and called out and hooted and made so much noise that, before they realized it, they had run right into the woods. But when the first trees had blotted out the sun, the men in the first rank grew frightened and stopped short, and the running women and children behind them bumped into them. The townspeople were shaken. They looked about uneasily at the trees above them and at the way the shadows crawled across their bodies. Then the darkness was too much. With a single shout, the men and women turned around and ran back the way they had come. After a quick glance around, the children ran after them. The little suns, the fires that burned that night in all the hearths of the village, seemed brighter and warmer than they ever had before. Mona never returned. Fearing the axes and fists, she stayed and lived in her bower for the rest of her life. She learned which ferns made a balm and which made a meal. She fished in deep pools and farmed in small meadows. And if occasionally she missed the powerful sun or the bright sunflowers or the laughter of others, she did not say. But strange, or was it? One day, years later, when she was old, past fearing the axes and fists, she heard human voices in the forest. Some she almost recognized, for they were the other children, grown old as she. They came tentatively into the woods, by ones and by twos and by threes. As they walked, they talked of her, of Mona, the pale girl, the child of the moon. And they saw the moonstones and the moonflowers and moonwort growing wild by the path. But though they searched for Mona in the green glades and in the hidden meadows, and they looked for her in the coppice, they never really found her where she waited, further out, always further out, in the place past the darkness where the sunlight and shadows met and danced together in ever-changing ways. Box Gavotte en Rondeau, the dance of Mona, the moon child. But though the children of her generation, now grown old and a little wiser, but though they searched for Mona in the green glades and in the hidden meadows, and they looked for her in the coppice, they never really found her where she waited, further out, always further out, in the place past the darkness, where the sunlight and shadows met and danced together in ever-changing ways. And that's where we want to be, our longing, even if we never quite get there, the place past the darkness, moving through the pain and confusion of the darkness into the energetic sunlight again. Here comes the sun. Good day, sunshine. But life's not only sunshine or darkness, as we've all experienced at times. The real joy lies where the sunlight and shadows meet and dance together in ever-changing ways. Light and dark, in and out, do-si-do with whatever partner, whatever event comes along next. So this has been Evening Under Lamplight with Robert Louis Abrahamson on Cambridge 105 Radio. Good night.